It's the 15th of March 2022. I'm Ray West of biglies.org, and I'm talking here to Chris Caskey, who's written a book, The War Against Goyim, Goyim being in quotes. And it's quite a nice book. I did a review of it, 350 pages. But I'll get him to talk about it anyway. So he's from New Zealand, for people who are not used to New Zealand accents. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. Yeah.
Good. Let me ask you about, you've got a historical background in history, university history from the Wellington University.
University of Otago.
Otago, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, New Zealand's first university.
First, you mean best? You mean oldest?
Oldest one, yeah.
Oldest established. Okay. Give me a background of your book, how you came to write it, and what the future you see for that kind of thing, assuming you do. You might have had opposition.
So my methodology was basically to survey a range of revisionist books, and revisionist meaning like basically revising history and from sort of a skeptical lens. That's loosely what it is. And
okay.
Yeah?
Oh, I was just going to say that some people use revisionist in a sort of aggressive sense.
It has negative connotations. Yeah.
Yeah. But when you say revisionist, you mean genuine, authentic.
Yes. Yeah.
Proper. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I would say.
So I surveyed a lot of books. I mean, it's got 986 endnotes, and I did borrow a lot of information from people. And I also looked conversely at books written by Jews about quote unquote anti-Semitism, found they were whitewashers. So I looked at both sides, included a great deal of Jewish sources, and it's a collection of 20 essays, and it's very broad, covers a huge range of topics, and I think that's the strength of the book. As you were saying, you wrote a glowing review of my book, and as you were saying, you know, a lot of revisionist or anti-Jewish books are quite narrow in scope.
Yes.
And there's a lot of examples of that, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's much better, much more convincing to have a wide overview of different topics, you know.
Okay. Let me just say here that we're doing this sort of on the fly. We're not reading from a script. So if it's a bit hesitant, that's the reason. But sometimes that works better than just reading stuff out as though it's the BBC or something.
Yeah.
Can I ask, you did a history degree.
Yeah.
How much of that did you, how much of you, if anything, that you learned from that, did you work into your book?
To be honest, it was more practice writing essays. And I think history students are some of the best essay writers. And it was more practice. Disappointingly, it was a lot of what we were taught was probably very similar to what people were taught in Britain or the USA.
Did you specialise in anything? I mean, I don't know how your system works. So you have majors, do you, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I majored in history and I got a minor in English. So they kind of complement each other. Yeah.
Did they do any sort of technical stuff on analysing manuscripts, that sort of thing?
We did work with archives. That's probably the extent of technical stuff.
That would be New Zealand archives?
Yes, yeah.
Right, so I mean you can, if you wanted to write on Maoris or something, you could do that.
Right.
Or Captain Cook. Yeah, that's great. I was impressed by your book, although I'm looking at my review again, I think I've underplayed the opening chapters, which are quite good, and those are quite short. For example, you've got one on the opening chapters on the construction of the Bible from all these rather ridiculous books. How did you do those opening chapters? They just sort of made sense to you at the time.
Let's see. So the first essay,
general points about Jews.
Might not be the best title, but it makes sense. I mean, that's what it is. The first sentence of my book was, it is amazing how so many people can travel around the world, graduate university, own businesses, etc., and yet not understand the significant influence of Jews in the world.
Yep,
and
that's
I do
absolutely
think
true.
It is amazing. And it's because it's been so heavily censored for millennia. Basically, in order to understand a lot of these problems facing the world, you know, you must understand Jews, you know.
Yep, I agree.
The case for a very long time.
It is quite extraordinary how much influence they've had. And in a sort of it's odd how unrecognized it is. If you look at the Bible, I mean, there's masses and masses of stuff on, you know, violence and wars and genocidal stuff, and yet people just don't seem to notice, possibly through the use of very flowering language, as in the King James Bible, for example.
Right. Yeah.
But of course, it does show the way. If you've got money, if you can fund these things, you can force people into it. There's a sort of channel that they get moved into. All these kids who do history kind of go through a similar thing. At least they do in the Western world. I mean, I presume there are local variations, of course. I mean, the history as it's taught in Russia must be, and China must be very different, assuming they teach any of it at all.
Right. Yeah. So who are Jews? So I'm going by the first essay, General Points About Jews. Who are Jews? Long story short, they're the people who wrote the Bible. Right, so the Bible, best-selling book ever, sold billions of copies, translated into probably more languages than any other book. You were saying, Ray, immense influence. And, you know, the Old Testament, which makes up most of the Bible, was written in Hebrew and Aramaic. And the New Testament, which came later, was written in Judeo-Koine Greek, sort of a Jewish-Greek hybrid. So the authors of those trash books were Jewish. And I say trash quite emphatically. I've got the next essay in my book, The Supremacy and Evil of Judaism. I go through all the Jewish holy books, starting with the Bible, the Old Testament, or the Tanakh, which is sort of their story, and then the Talmud, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Zohar. And there's just many, many passages of supremacy and evil and against Goyim.
I think Isaiah was one of the primary examples of that, but I may be wrong. You've got Deuteronomy and Joshua.
Deuteronomy, I think that the supplementary hypothesis is probably true, which is basically that Deuteronomy is the oldest book of the Bible, and that it's the fifth book in the canon. But basically, this hypothesis posits that like the four books that preceded in the canon were actually prequels, and I think that's probably true. So the first Jewish book that was written about 600 BCE, I think, contained all these passages of violence and exterminating the Canaanites, and which you don't really find in any other religion. And you mentioned Isaiah. I may as well quote, here's something from Isaiah, and this is the best-selling book ever, right, in the whole world of the Bible. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 15, 16. Whoever is captured will be thrust through, all who are caught will fall by the sword, their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes, their houses will be looted and their wives violated, i.e. raped. See, you know, and it goes on, and this Bible's replete with passages like that. And that just simply it's you know, not the talk of a loving God. It's pretty obvious. And
are you happy with Björknes's view of this? He thinks that the way he describes it, as I understand him, is that the Jews were afraid of their God and did all this stuff to please him. That may be a
I think that was
rationalization of it.
Yeah. So I read Beware the World to Come. I think that came out in 2020.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is. There's an update, actually. There's a PDF update. It's
Okay,
more or less,
yeah.
it's very similar, except that his big long middle chapter is now split up into, I think it's four
Very
new
interesting book.
chapters.
The main thing I took away from that book is something called, and this is going to sound kind of a bit like ridiculous explaining this, but it's their beliefs, not my beliefs. So it's called the serpent seed idea, or the jewel seed line idea. It was originally a Gnostic idea, but basically it's in the Zohar, which is a Jewish book that came later. And basically they claim that Adam and Eve, everybody's heard of Adam and Eve, that Jews descend from Adam and Eve, right? Non-Jews, who they disparagingly call Gwen, descend from Eve and Satan. Now, because in the Garden of Eden, Satan disguised himself as a snake and impregnated Eve, and then they bore Cain. And then the Jews claim in the Zohar, this book, that Cain was the first non-Jew, and that all non-Jews descend from Cain, who's satanic. And that's, it's absolute, obviously you couldn't have a whole population descending from, two people. It's ridiculous. Or a snake or whatever. It's just complete, utter bullshit. But anyway, that's a good example of the, that's just extremely racist, to say that, that the whole, 8 billion people, Gwen, descend from Satan, basically.
Yeah.
That's just insanity.
You don't think the word racist is part of Jewish propaganda itself. I mean, there are racial differences. Some
yeah,
of them,
because
yeah, medical ones,
Yeah, because it's the word's never applied to Jews,
No.
I think it may have been coined by Jews in the USSR, Trotsky.
Do you have a view on this as a kind of process or set of rules? Or algorithms, which if you have algorithms to work from, it will produce a certain type of society, assuming they actually follow them.
That's a very good question. Do you mind elaborating a bit on that?
If you take,
I get what you're saying, but yeah.
Take examples from the animal kingdom. I mean, with fish, some fish are crowding tolerant. They can, if you put loads of them into a pond or something, they get on with each other reasonably well. But there are some fish which are dangerous, and they're not tolerant of crowds. They sort of go around eating things.
Yeah.
And these presumably are genetic patterns developed in the same way that, well, it's to do with food as much as anything, isn't it? In the same way that you can get things like tapeworms, which definitely exist, and you would definitely get those living off the food of other animals living in their digestive tracts and so on. Now, with the unusual feature of people is that they've got this much more learning capacity and language as well. I mean, their mouths are adapted just with a lower jaw and a tongue. You can have the most fantastically elaborate language. And I just get the feeling that Jews happened to be in on the start of it. For example, they had, the Mediterranean is an important place. They had, it's calm. You don't get, you do get storms, but compared to the open ocean, it's relatively calm. And you've got it, and it's a huge area. It's the biggest inland sea anywhere in the world. So, and the Jews managed to get, I think they got iron first, actually, or something like that. And I think they probably had money first. And maybe they were first with language. Although it may be that it wasn't them, they just nicked it from somebody else. They just copied the ideas. But if this turns out to be, if it spreads and people have got the brains to see what's going on, then that could be part of their downfall. One has to. Anyway, sorry, I'm wandering off the point really. But I'm just saying that. I mean, the one of the examples here is this Kahal business, which I was trying to talk about. There was a book published in 1869, according to my notes here, somebody called Jacob Brafman, Brafman with two N's, Kniga Kagal, the book is the Book of the Kahal.
Yeah.
It's a translation to Russian. It sounds a bit like the thinkings of Zion. It's supposed to be a translation to Russian of the minutes of the Kahila of Minsk, believe it or not. And it has a lot of information on what their actual procedure is. They have an organization exclusively for Jews against everybody else, and they have their meetings, and they regard non-Jewish areas as an empty wasteland, occupied by people-shaped living things, regard as cattle. And the cattle analogy is quite an accurate one, I think. So if you look at fields of cattle in eating grass and stuff, it's easy to have contempt for them, or view them as being sort of worthless. Anyway, what the Kahal does is they want to gain ownership of things, and that's a kind of legal concept, and it's kept secret. So what the Kahal did was sell rights to parcels of property to a Jew, right? So Jew A would get the rights to, something, a farm or something. Jew B would get rights to a brewery, that kind of thing. Or another one would get rights to a horse breeder in those days when they horse transport was. And then the Jew is instructed to become the master of the property and exploit it as far as possible. And non-Jews can only borrow from the Jew who bought the stuff originally. It's quite it's a sort of closed system with quite elaborate rules. And you can imagine if you had a game like one of these games where you follow rules, that it would sort of automatically work, provided that people don't get suspect. And I think a lot of Jewish policies are like that, as opposed to others. I mean, if you get non-Jew farmers or whatever it may be, businessmen, they don't seem to have a similar well worked out scheme. That's all I'm saying. It's a difficult thing to answer, but that's what has to be looked at to try and assess the situations and the likely future. Because if you look at the system now, they've had this COVID thing, which I attribute to Jews, and they've demonstrated control over the whole of the world, really. They've got people everywhere wearing these ridiculous masks, and all of a sudden they've changed to another system with money, making money out of Russia and the Ukraine, and so on. So you can see, once you see what's going on, you can generalize it. You can think, I see, you've seen this pattern before, for example, in the Napoleonic Wars and so on, or Cromwell. And that's very, very important. It's not surprising that's been kept secret. That book by Braffman is the only one I've heard of like that.
It's available in English, is it?
These days you can do machine translation,
right?
Which is quite high quality, so it doesn't matter as much as it used to. I don't think that's very efficient, isn't it? Machine translation. I've translated some of Miles Mathis's papers into. I did one on I used a thing called DeepL, so it claims to be the best language translator there is. I don't know. I haven't tried to check that by translating it back into English from their version. But anyway, Mathis's article on Mussolini, and I put his pieces on Hitler translated into German up on my site here, and I've got some Russian translations. I don't know if what they think. I've not got very few hits, but not zero hits. I think they get nosed at by quotes intelligence people. The expansion caused by internet is really quite, compared with what it used to be. These things are just fantastic. I mean, you can translate into Chinese, for example, and it looks fantastic. You can see there's something going on there.
So do you want me to get back to answering your question about Judaism and how their behavior,
go ahead.
So Yeah, I think I'm just going off the cuff here. Jews always put a tremendous emphasis on reading and writing. You know, they'll, I mean, and that's demonstrated by all their books. You know, the Bible and the Talmud, huge corpus of books and other books. And I think for most people throughout history, literacy wasn't very important in their daily lives. You know, if you wanted literacy, you know, you consulted a professional, you know. But the Jews
Yes.
were kind of ahead of the curve in that respect. That gave them an advantage. And I think you were talking about like parallels with like creatures like fish and parasites and so on. There's also
Yes.
dogs. In my book, I describe the parallel with dogs, how there's, you know, different breeds of dogs are kind of breed for different purposes. So some
Yep.
dogs might help guide blind people, you know. Some dogs might, you know, they're good at strong scent, you know, they sniff for drugs at
Yeah,
airports, that
that's
kind of
true.
thing. Some dogs are, you know, very fast.
Some are point. Have you heard of pointers? Do you have pointers in New Zealand? Get these dogs. They sort of get
Heard of
rigid,
them.
and they just look, align their bodies to a birds or something flying around. They're called
Right.
pointers.
So you've got natural selection, which is pretty self-explanatory concept. Well, not self-explanatory, but it's easy enough to understand.
Yep.
I think a lot of people are familiar with that. And then there's another concept called cultural selection, which you could class that as artificial selection. So, you know, Jews historically, you know, as we discussed, they had these ethics against goyim, you know, anti-goyim ethics,
Yeah.
which wasn't just that was an integral part of their religion, and they lived in ghettos voluntarily, very cloistered communities, self-segregated, and they had the kahal system, which was like a state within a state,
Yes.
and they had their own laws and so on. And I think that basically, like, if you were on board with Jewish religion, the Jewish culture, almost everybody back in time was religious, right? That was kind of the norm.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I know they
Well,
kind of
well,
project.
I think
Well.
atheism is the default position, I think, but I think maybe throughout the Middle Ages, you know, most people followed some kind of religion, but Jews m were more attentive to it, I think, than other, because they
Okay.
and basically so religion was like the what kind of the kind of the influence that affected their selection. So if you weren't on board, if you're say you were living a Jewish person living in a ghetto or the Kahal, and you didn't like the religion, you thought it was unethical or whatever, which is true, you know, and you decided to leave. You know, so they lost ethical people through like apostasy, if that makes sense. So over time, it would just refine their gene pool, would be like less diverse. There'd just be more and more like kind of
Yeah.
dishonest, cruel people, and then by the time you had these huge outbursts of so-called revolutions in our France and Russia and Germany and elsewhere, you know, that I think at that point it didn't matter if even if they were atheists by that point, that this had been ingrained into them, and that it also explains, I think, why very, very few Jews have spoken out, and we see like almost any Jew in a influential position in the media or finance or whatever, is almost all of them are corrupt. I think so. That's kind of my kind of hypothesis.
Yeah, I think that's, well, it could be quantified, couldn't it? I mean, if you have a generation in, say, 20 or 25 years, and there's just a, like a 5% move towards fanaticism, then over a few hundred years, it can, in the same way that, some dogs can, you can breed little dogs or medium-sized dogs or whatever, and it, except that the process you're describing is well, it's not. They're sort of bred by the presumably by the rabbis or the authorities. But this is slightly relevant. What do you think of the caste system in India? Have you looked into the historical stuff of these things? Because that could be a...
I'm vaguely familiar with it. Sorry, I haven't looked into it.
Oh, okay, it doesn't matter. Okay, are you carrying on with discussing parasitic things?
Yeah, I think the principal problem with Jews is that they're dishonest. And an excellent example of this is the Holocaust hoax. Literally, like, thousands of eyewitnesses lied again and again, and it's all proven wrong. For example, I'd recommend listeners consult the Holocaust Handbook series. It's like more than 40 books proving it's a hoax, and that's that's a huge topic, but if you learn about that and cross-reference it with this, that'll make a lot of sense. And we see with
in a way it's a negligible topic, isn't it? Something which they've deliberately invented, and they exploit it. They say that because Jews want lots of damaging immigration to white countries, and that's a perfectly sensible policy because at one time there were 6 million of them were destroyed. It's a complete bullshit. I mean, the reason for it is a complete fake.
Their claim that Europeans victimized them is bullshit, yeah. And extending back in the past, pogroms and other sob stories are also bullshit.
They do appear to be like, yes, all right, I don't know a huge amount about that. Although Andrew Joyce, who writes for the Oxygen, for Kevin McDonald.
Basically, the point is a lot of people know Jews as, the phrase scapegoat is a Jewish word, a Jewish idea. That's Jews are history scapegoats, and I found that more or less the exact opposite is the case. And there's a lot in my book about wars and genocides arranged by Jews, like the Jewish genocide of Armenians, Assyrians, and Greeks. Very unknown. Jews pretended to be Muslims, controlled the Ottoman Empire, and through their networking, also with Freemasonry, they had religious motivations, and they also had like business motivations to control the empire, organize those genocides, blame the Muslims. So they're actually scapegoating people. And then similar things happened in the USSR, Germany.
It's quite amazing. Yeah. They also installed a new elite, didn't they, in Arabia, so-called Saudi Arabia, the Jews as well. This is a thing where Miles Mathis was very good on this. He thought he had a new theory of the Crusades. He thought the point of the Crusades was to get Jews from the Middle East to go back into Europe and mingle with the moneyed families. So he's got exactly the opposite view from the normal, which is, it's very interesting. He's, we're in an era where you need exciting new hypotheses to be tested, because all the old ones are running in ruts. I mean, he was very good on Napoleon as well. He thinks a lot of Napoleonic wars were faked, or if you're a textbook writer, you can invent a whole load of stuff. And
those wars, Jews funded both sides of those wars, and those funds were instrumental, like the Rothschilds made so much money from wars. Their wealth exceeded the wealth of some nations. It's incredible.
It's not exactly true to say they supported them, is it? I mean, they gave them money, but they weren't supporting them in the way that family might support a war by going, by risking death. Their support was giving money and expecting it back, and also expecting back the opponent's money as well. And of course, they had this, maybe it was a mathematical thing, they appreciated that if you have payments over hundreds of years, they add up, fairly obvious point. So they whereas other people are just thinking of maybe their lifetime or maybe a year's income or something. They were thinking
Yeah.
much bigger.
I
And once it's
included
pointed.
some of this just absolutely staggering. There's one in my book. Let me just get to it. It shouldn't take a moment. Sorry, almost there.
Which chapter are you
So,
looking at?
I'm looking at Jewish Zionist wars in the Middle East at the end. It's page 236 to 37.
Right.
And so the wars waged by the USA and the extended coalition against Middle Eastern countries, this is since 2001, so like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, those places, cost American taxpayers, and I wrote, a stupefying $6.4 trillion. And to see that number written in numerals, it's just absolutely amazing. So really, those wars were never voted for. Most huge protests against those wars, but it turns out that the perpetrators were Jewish, had ties to Israel,
Yeah.
and they posed as neo-conservatives. And
Neocons, yeah.
and that was all motivated by Israel, and it was just horrible. Again, that was sort of an example of those. That I mean, 6.4 trillion. That's from Brown University, by the way.
Yes, I've seen that.
And that's going to be paid off over a very long time, but that's a good example of the consequences of Jews, because if you're paying taxes and there's the controlling policies that are not consistent with public interests and you have to pay for it, that's people
Do you
aren't
have
going to
any
want that. Yeah.
views on valuation? The way that the traditional sort of actuarial way of valuing things is by looking at an asset and looking at the payments you get from it and discounting them. The longer the time scale, the more you discount them. But the
Okay.
trouble is that's perfectly good in a if you've got a stable system, that's okay. But if you've got hyperinflation or values changing all the time, there are problems with it, which nobody seems to, you get these people saying something like the such and such a person is worth, 3 billion, meaning that they are part of a major industry, and 3 billion is a figure you get by sort of juggling around. But of course, if they lose it, if somebody takes it from them, or if the legal system stops supporting them, and they can go down to nothing straight away. So there is a
Yeah.
severe problem with valuation. And of course, I think Jews are, I think they are a bit kind of gullible about these things. I think they are themselves a bit gullible. I know so their victims are gullible. So I think if you get somebody like Kissinger and he's going to make a few billion, that seems
Yeah.
it kind of attracts them, even though they don't. It may not work out that way. So you get the horrible sort of backup thing, where these. I mean, both. If you look at the chancellors of the Exchequer in Britain, since they say about 1900, since Jews became important in political parties,
Yeah.
these are all. They're all Jews, I think, or virtually all Jews. And I mean, I think some of them. I think George Gordon Brown, he was the chancellor in about 19. About 2010, I think it was 25, something like
Yeah.
that. And I think he's responsible for giving money from Britain to Soros. Soros. There was some manipulation that went on, and Gordon Brown sold Britain's gold reserves, all a large
Yeah.
number, of, large portion of them. And I think, in
And
a way, Soros has been handed a load of money.
so Soros funds these Black Lives Matter protesters in
He funds
America
all this kind of crap,
and
yeah, and it.
lots of stuff. But the thing is with those organizations is, unbeknownst to many members of Black Lives Matter, they're run by Jews, and it's not, they don't give a fuck about blacks at all. They're just superficial support,
Yeah.
because I mean, historically, Jews made fortunes on the transatlantic slave trade of Africans. It's American Jewry built up huge amount of wealth from that, and I cover that in my book. Most of that, actually, Jews admit it themselves in their own history books. And that was hundreds of years of control, like, really, yeah. And that's that's still omitted in when I went to university, it was omitted. And
was it really? That was only recently, wasn't it?
Well, I think
like a few years ago.
Then I think the Nation of Islam and Tony Martin, I think, got onto the, I think early 90s, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, it's a lot of jumping around a lot, but
it is. That's life, isn't it?
They're all related. You know, so many topics are related. Yeah.
Can I just ask you what you think of this Christianity point of view? I think, in my view, which may be wrong, it's Roman Catholic, Church to start with. They split up into other Jew-controlled things. But the Roman Catholics were banned interest. I think they took that from the Greeks or something. But they banned interest. In effect, anything big, anything that needed financing.
Yeah.
Like quarries, I've got a list of quarries, shipbuilding, cathedrals, armies, or printed Bibles. They were expensive. Written Bibles were even more expensive. But in order to get anything big, you'd have to get money from Jews. So the Jews, in effect, came to control anything big.
So the Catholic Church condemned, they call it usury, lending money, charging interest is a sin. Your point is that the interest is acceptable if it's fair, you know, like if it's only like 1% or 2% or.
Well, I don't want to quantify it particularly. I'm just saying that it's not surprising that they'd want interest on it. And it's not surprising. In effect, the Christian policy made it illegal to get money except through Jews. So Jews were the church was acting as a support for Jews, a symbiotic relationship with Jews. In exchange for giving Jews money, the church themselves, they became big landowners. I think most of Britain certainly was owned by the church, even including land which is not worth much. And but nobody says this. Nobody. I was looking up cathedrals, and there's no cathedral in Cambridge, the university town, and there's only a tiny cathedral in Oxford. I think that's a sort of mute concession to the fact that Jews were controlled the main money. They didn't want. They didn't want Anglican or Catholic cathedrals in Oxford and Cambridge. They wanted it to be elsewhere. I mean, for example, what's it called? Hereford. Yeah, Hereford, I believe, has the biggest collection of handwritten or early Bibles anywhere. They were very expensive.
Yeah, I got some stuff in my book. Like, Jews were known to control finance back in ancient times. I've heard that the reason why coins have the ridges on them was that was originally invented by the Romans to prevent Jews from clipping the coins, shaving off the edges.
Middle edges, yeah, that's true.
And they were charging, in Roman era, Jews would be controlling the finance and charging interest rates of up to 48% per annum, I think.
Yeah, really, I think some of these figures are so... These figures are so high that they're obviously designed to, they're designed to bankrupt the people, make them unable to pay.
Yeah.
And they were not allowed, incidentally, they were not allowed to get their mates to chip it in. It had to be their own usury, their own particular people. It's all designed as far as possible.
How would Catholics in the modern age hope to have a modern economy without interest? You know, how could they? I don't think they could do it.
There's a sentimental feeling, isn't there? They all think they don't know anything about history, so they think the times when the church was big were a good thing. In fact, it was a disaster. It's not very different from what the system is now. They'd have people burnt at the stake. I mean, that was the reason they did that. It wasn't for religious reasons. It was because if you've got these people damaging the Jewish and the Jew sympathisers, they didn't want that. They wanted to keep their money, so they just sort of burnt them. And it's quite an effective system, isn't it? I mean, if you, as you were saying earlier, that when he chatted that the Saxons were decapitated by Charlemagne in the Middle Ages. Yeah. And that wasn't for the reason that was because, you know, if the church got a hand in these places, they get their tithes, they get 10%,
yeah,
and people get guaranteed income. It may not seem at the present day, it may not seem very large, but
yeah,
at the time it was, yeah. I mean, you can see in
it's okay. Just jotted down some notes here, so yeah, there was some major papal bulls protecting Jews, you know, that Jews should not be harmed. And it was kind of a quid pro quo arrangement where, you know, the Jews...
Eudaeus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Where the Jews can't harm the Goyim, but the Goyim can't harm the Jews. It was bullshit, because like you said, they were controlling the commerce and behind-the-scenes intrigues. A lot of... families like the Medici and Mathis has investigated those. A lot of those were Jewish. A lot of popes were Jewish as well. It's not actually much of a stretch, really, like if you understand things. Decapitation. The Noahide laws. The Jews are trying to impose them. And that's creeping up. Basically, it's seven laws designed by Jews for non-Jews to keep. But and it's just stupid crap. Like I've got them in my book. It's like do not murder or whatever. Like just crap. Which the funny thing in the Bible, that only applies to fellow Jews. Do not murder fellow Jews, but it's okay to murder Goyim. But anyway, the thing is, they want to usher in these laws, and they're getting support from the UN and US government. And but the thing is, in Judaism, the punishment for disobeying those laws is decapitation. So this is something Bjerknes has warned about, that they want to introduce these and get Goyim to enforce it on each other.
Yeah,
so it's ridiculous that these things get support. But that's
is there a supposed connection with Noah?
Noah's supposed to be
So what he said on after his flood.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is unbelievable.
Very scientific story, you know, the flood. Very credible.
it's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, the penetration of biblical stuff and imagery is incredible.
Oh,
everybody's heard of these things.
Kids, you know, cartoons, you know, of Noah's Ark and Adam and Eve. And
yeah.
Children thought about it, and it's actually this violent plan to enslave people, well, pretty much.
Can I ask you on nukes? I was pleased that you'd identified Roger Desjardins of Canada, who is actually he thinks that nuclear power is a myth, which is probably true, I think. Unfortunately, he's one of these people who doesn't talk to anybody. He's offline. He may even be dead. I mean, when he was active, it was at least about, say, 15 years ago. So he might have passed on. But that your nuclear stuff is good. I'm not. You must get people who are terrified that Putin is going to drop nukes. But I think that's just fantasy. I don't think they exist. I'm not the least bit worried about that. And
yeah,
I think Mathis is correct on the Russia versus Ukraine. I think that's fake. I've got a quite nice video, I think it was by Kolostrom, showing him walking around.
Nicholas Kolostrom, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
He didn't make it. With these amateur videos, you don't get, they don't seem to use video editing, so you don't know the date or who paid it or anything.
Yeah.
It's kind of rather sad, really. But yeah, there's, you know, him strolling around in these places, sort of looking around, and faintest trace of any weaponry going on, any, you know, any heavy Boeing or anything.
Yeah, so I got my essay. Let me just get to it.
Sorry, I just thought I ought to mention that because
people should know about that. Because people have gotten interested in the Holocaust hoax, and of course, this was the same period, you know, 1945.
Yeah. Did you look at any DVDs? You can get DVDs of
Yeah,
that
I
was
didn't look
quite
at
an.
any, actually.
Okay.
I did look at some of your videos, though,
I'm afraid
that you
they've
put
been
up.
largely destroyed by YouTube, which is very annoying. It's a lot of work with these things. But yeah, there were
Yeah.
some quite good nuke
Because
videos.
you personally looked at footage of nuke tests and
Yeah.
found they were
Yeah.
fake.
Well, you can. The thing is, you can look at frame by frame, and you can see
Right.
typically what they do is you have a dark one single dark frame, and then a sort of bright one following it. So it looks as though you've got this kind of impression that something's suddenly gone bright. But of course, the chance of a nuclear bomb going off in exactly a whatever, a 30th of a second or so, this completely contradicts the received view. In fact, incidentally, I also looked into that filmmaker, the 2001 chap who's Jewish as well, of course. Fuck, I can't remember. Kubrick, yeah. And
Oh,
he's
right.
the last bit of. I think the reason they made How I Came to Love the Bomb, or whatever it is, the reason that was in black and white was because all the. There's a sequence of about, I don't know, 5 minutes or so of these atomic things at the end, and they're all black and white because it's more difficult to fake things.
Oh,
And
right.
so.
Yeah. An argument that appealed to me was the I think you made this point in the Nuke Lies forum, which is on your site, about the color of these explosions. That like if nukes are allegedly millions of degrees, but the all the footage of them, it's like orange and yellow colored, like an ordinary flame. And it's
Yeah,
like if
that's
it
right.
was like obviously blue flame's hotter than orange flame, so they should have been like white hot or something, not these like, because I think reading like orange like indicates like unburned carbon, is that
Yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
Hydrocarbons burning.
so that's basically, I mean, isn't that obvious though? Like, why don't people, I don't
Well, it is.
know.
I think that's the effect of saturation propaganda, that people just don't think outside it. And that's what happened with the Second World War and the First World War. This is a point.
Yeah.
I think Mathis got this wrong, actually. He said that it's unprecedented, this business with people wearing masks and COVID. But it's not unprecedented. They had, if you got control of information, and during the Second World War, of course, there was complete control, full censorship. And
Yeah.
the idea, it was just impossible to get these ideas across, that Hitler was himself a Jewish asset,
Yeah.
as they say. And all the, well, I've got some stuff which I downloaded from Hexane. I presume it's pronounced Hexane. He's a French writer who's been almost ignored. I found him
Yeah,
by
and
careful looking.
I recommend people who are listening to read his material. Was it Puzzles About World War II? Let me just biglies.org. 30 problems with the traditional view of the Second World War. And there's a list of different topics. Very interesting.
Yeah, they're all good points. They're all very. I
Yeah.
mean, I think once you plow through that, and of course, it's not surprising that all this stuff is censored because they want people
Yeah.
to be cattle, don't they? They want them not to, and
Well, even
of
I mean, you talk
course.
about like World War II, Japan, they actually officially announced that they were firebombed. They had radio broadcasts, we're firebombed, by they described the planes, they described, the incendiary explosions, and all the eyewitnesses said that too, except for a couple that they make up. And that was censored,
Okay. It sounds as
it's
though you read that was from First Class Skeptic.
yep, I
He's
think it
a very
was.
good
I've got
chap,
him
isn't
in my end notes,
he?
my
Yeah, he was
ether.
from Illinois. I don't know what he's doing now. He was very good on sort of things like newspaper articles and the way things change, and also building models. He built a model of what the atom bomb was supposed to have been like in
Yeah.
Hiroshima, and it wouldn't fit together. The pieces
It was
wouldn't
just a
fit,
prop, like I think it
and
was.
it's a prop. Yeah, and the error. In fact, one of them, the Fat Boy, I think it was called, was there based on a British bomb. It's
Yeah.
British. Anyway, I do wish you'd, had an index in your book, actually, although, of course, it's asking a lot, because preferably an ideas index as well, but of course, that's very difficult, and it would be quite long.
I'll consider that for the future, definitely. With
Well, it would be a bugger to do, I mean.
Right, you're with the PDF version. If you you can search for words with Control
yeah.
F.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
So that's helpful.
But yeah, it's very good. But what's needed really is an ideas index where you can look at, because when you read these books, you suddenly think, oh, there's a policy, a procedure, some kind of attitude that flickers before your eyes. And then you read on a bit and you kind of forget it. So what you really want, what would be nice would be an ideas index, but that's very difficult. I don't think professional indexers could do that even. It's much easier just to have a few lines, and some of these indexes are really quite useful. Really quite useless. We have about, say, 50 references to, say, Holocaust, for the sake of argument, and with page numbers. You've got to look up every single one of them if you want to find something, which is kind of ridiculous, really, isn't it? Oh, I was just looking here. Lestrade has just put up a thing on Iwo Jima and saying that was a fake battle. So you do get fake battles, of course. You get real ones, and real ones which are suppressed. I mean, my website started with a piece on the Vietnam War, and of course that's largely all the atrocities kept secret. And America is very sad. You get people, if they're paid, people will commit all kinds of atrocities, and they're not aware of. I was watching the film The Sting. I was watching The Sting the other day just to see. It's absolute crap, all of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's the stuff about the Depression and all these people willing to go to great lengths because of some black who got killed and stuff. It's just Jewish garbage.
Yeah.
Anyway. Sorry, I'm wandering off.
Yeah, well,
there
do,
is a point, I'm wandering off it.
You do a lot of book reviews and movie reviews on your website, and I think that's great.
I like to do that.
Quite
critical,
quite penetrating.
Well, no, thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's aimed really, it's aimed at young people as much as anything, because somebody will say, well, look at this book. And, I mean, for example, there was one called Monopoly Capital by two Jews, Baron and Sweezy. I remember it was in the circulation. Yeah, I've got a copy which is 50 years old, something like that. I think it came out in about 1968 or 70.
Wow.
Is that 50 years old? But, and, you know, if you see in a book list somewhere, there's this book, it's good to have an acid critique of it.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to university, we were recommended to read various books. One of them was one on the so-called atomic bombs by Jung, German Jew. It was called Brighter Than a Thousand Suns. It's part of the bullshit. That's why they have these videos all done at night, in case you can't see them. Anyway, so I do like to do reviews, even if they're quite out of date.
Yeah.
Just for people to look at. I hope it works. I think, you see, when I was your age, roughly, I was a squatter in London, in some North London near King's Cross. I was disillusioned by the academic stuff. And I didn't know at the time that, you see, if you're a Jew, you get automatic sort of push through.
It's a lot of nepotism, you know, like in Hollywood was created by Jews, and all the American news companies all run by Jews. Quite easy to verify, and they promote their own, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of those families.
Freemasons have these secrets. Like, for example, I found the other day reading a couple of books on it, that they call the son of a Freemason is called a Lewis. I don't know if. For example, I was listening to Louis Armstrong, who called himself Lewis. I wondered if that was. There's a TV series called Lewis. Do wonder whether that's a little message. And they have this business with the handshake, with putting your thumb in the middle joint of the other fingers. I think it has to be your thumb. If you do that, then you're believed to be a Freemason. Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's hard to believe that, I mean, you even have pirate ships and stuff with some of these people, Arabs, you know, doing the distress signal, and then all the other lots that would take them on board, and it would be nice to
yeah.
There should be a general theory of secrecy, actually. It's, I mean, it looks rather obvious that what happens with secrecy, but the way it's actually used is can be is important.
Yeah.
It can be, you know.
Name changes are a good example of that. Mathis is very good on Hitler. He thinks Hitler's real name was Hiller. And if you look at his all his family surnames were Jewish, you know, like his mother's surname was Polzl, like Polzl, Jewish. And you look at censuses, it's like Polzl, Jewish, 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 Jewish. It's incredible, you know, and that, yeah, and a lot of others. There's a lot of examples of this, but that's one that's been a perennial technique. Changing that Jews didn't originally have surnames, but they adopt them and they blend in, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. If you were in a little ghetto, you don't really need them, do you?
No.
I was just looking at here at Hitler and other. There are people now who think they're being, you know, very edgy in supporting Hitler, whereas in fact, because a lot of the Hitler websites online are Jew supported, because for reasons that Hexane looks at. And I mean, I've got four examples of Brandon Martinez. He's quite a good Spaniard, and he's quite interesting because he doesn't like Palestinians, because of course the Palestinians, Arabs, invaded Spain for many centuries, 700 years, and so he thinks they deserve to have been chucked out. But anyway, he thinks Hitler was the bee's knees. So does Jan Lamprecht in South Africa. He's a very good chap, but he's a bit obsessed with toys. He wants, his idea of war is that you get loads of weaponry costing a fortune, and you go out there and sort of shoot at people. Not normally, they don't shoot at the Jews, of course, they just shoot at black victims, typically. And there's also Deanna Spingola and Carolyn Yeager, and I've spoken to both of those, but they're not into this business of.
I think Renegade Tribune's another popular website, sort of in the same vein as those ones.
Yeah, they do change, of course. I mean, sometimes they seem to change their whole policy. I've got two sites called Jadar, my Jadar piece, and the Joff one. For lack of a better word, I called it Joff, Jews Off the Radar. So one of them is supposed to be activist sites, and the other one is the opposite, people pretending to be. So I've got, I try and put this stuff up. It's taken me years, actually. Whenever I find one, I put it on, basically. But that thing is, I think that's slowly changing. You know, I think it's partly because of the lapse of time, and partly because of criticism of these old, you know, you see these old blokes with their medals, and they haven't a clue what they fought for, or what they thought they fought for.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
Do you want to say some more about your book? I mean, I'm not sure whether this is about your book, or about you, or about me.
Yeah, but, ask away.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about just people generally. I was sitting in this garden centre yesterday, having coffee and a free cake, and I was looking at all these people. I didn't ask anybody, but I did wonder. I bet almost none of them have heard of the word goyim. Almost none of them, and it is kind of it is depressing how little impact has been made by all their activities over the years. Do you think that, or are you an optimist or something?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think
do you
most
think
of them.
Change?
I think most of them would agree with us. But getting them to that point, like if they if they read our material, I think most people would agree with us for sure. I mean, I think they would, but I don't
There's an
know.
absorption period, isn't there?
Right.
They'd have to spend time, getting to see it. So it's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have any possible points of attack? I mean, I thought if you look at the way the Jewish model is to have one, have to have a number of Jews in all the capital cities,
Yeah.
or significant financial or industrial points, and of course they use their own personal language to communicate with each other,
Yeah.
and of course they can travel as well. I mean, the which I remember reading a C.P. Snow novel, and in it the chap, the C.P. Snow character was gawping at this Jew who's in a foreign country in Britain, which is foreign to him,
Yeah.
lived in this big house, and so he didn't realize that of course if you have this business with nepotism, you can just sort of go and visit, maybe as an interim point you could find a Freemasons club. But I mean, they have their own little, it's much easier, they've got their languages. It's a bit like the British Empire must have been. You get these people, they could go to their clubs and things, and
Yeah.
the so-called British Empire, I think. I mean, it's rather depressing how little of it survives, really. I mean, they must have had big shipping stuff and so on. There is a museum at Greenwich, where the Greenwich Meridian was invented with splendidly Eurocentric line, but they're all these kind of Jewish type pseudo museums.
Yeah.
I expect you get that in New Zealand,
Oh
I don't.
yeah, there's yeah, it's pretty ubiquitous, but good example in the USA, in I think in Washington DC, there's the Hollyhocks Memorial Museum. I think I can't remember how much money that it was. I think more, like it was a lot, millions and millions. But nearby, there's a like it's a whole huge museum devoted to allegedly 6 million victims. But then nearby, there's a monument for the victims of communism, which is
Is that a sort of
it could be
street corner thing?
tens of millions of victims of communism over decades, and that monument's just a little statue. That's all. So that's all the goyim get. And that's like right in the capital of America, and that's pretty disgusting. And then you understand that Jews controlled so-called communism from the beginning, and Mathis is good on that too. How there were original like socialists, people like Bakunin and Proudhon, then Marx and his mentor Hesse, and that crowd was given money, and they were sent in to control the opposition to prevent the middle class from allying with the lower class, because as Mathis pointed out, it wasn't the bourgeoisie who controlled the companies, it was the rich industrialists, because bourgeois means middle class, but it was the upper class of Jews controlling it. So that was a distraction. And then the biggest series of genocides ever in the USSR, and famines and really sadistic methods, and I cover a lot of that in my book, and I probably sp I'll spare people the details because it's horrible, but again, you're talking about like how they cooperate and stuff, and something that struck me was I think in 1920 there were 500,000 Jews working in the Soviet Union, like affiliated with the government, like working in various fields, and a lot of them went over to join up with it. And of course, all the leaders were Jewish, and Lenin and Trotsky, and later Stalin and Kaganovich and Beria, and just all the way from right from the top, all the way trickle down, like very, very Jewish dominated for decades. And that only well, there was a controlled collapse in 1991, and then the oligarchs got away with billions. And then now you've got this the inflaming with the media, hostility between Russia and Ukraine, and of course Prime Minister and President of both Russia and Ukraine are Jewish, or Putin probably is. I mean, there's a lot of
Yeah, I
ties, you
think
know.
so.
But
Can I just rewind you a bit there? You said that
yeah.
the oligarchs got away with billions, but you see, that's where this is where I have doubts about it, because they must, I presume they mean by that that they controlled things like aluminium plants and agricultural plants. But as long as they could get, as long as they got their dividends, then that's valuable, that's worth having.
Yeah.
But I think if they were sort of cut down somewhere, they could be just made, just bankrupted. Just they could be, their stuff could be worth nothing. I don't know for a
Right.
fact, because of course this is the sort of thing that's not discussed. The people are not used to, most people are not used to handling
Well, an
millions of
interesting interesting example of that is diamonds. There's
Oh,
an
yeah.
essay in my book, hold up, what's it called?
Yeah, that's quite a good
Jewish,
chat. I mean, I haven't seen anybody address that,
the
the whole
Jewish,
issue,
the
animal
Jewish
issue.
diamond industry and conflict diamonds. So, Jews control diamond and gold mine and other minerals in South Africa and originally and where else was it? There was the Boer War where the they got Goyim in the UK and New Zealand and Australia and stuff to secure those resources at
Yeah,
the behest
absolutely.
of
Yeah.
Jews, yeah. And like the big companies like De Beers, you know, Jewish and all the others. And then there was this where there was this huge media marketing campaign to promote diamonds. And that's an
Diamonds are forever.
example. Diamond is forever, exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
that was all Jewish, and I explore that in my book.
I did hear that
And
they're
the
doing
point
something.
about, sorry, I'll just say this
No, go
quickly,
on.
that diamonds kind of have the, well, they can be useful, like they're very hard. I mean, you could use them like for drill bits, for example, if you're mining a diamond tip drill bit. But their kind of value as jewelry, that kind of does depend on the media and the propaganda. If that hadn't, those a lot of those Jews who made billions from diamonds wouldn't have made that money without the media push. And
I was sorry, I was just about to say that as far as I know, there's something similar in Japan. There's no tradition of diamonds in Japan, but I think they're trying to push them as, rings or something. It's exactly the
okay.
same idea. Whether successful, I don't know. Perhaps the Japanese are a bit more, well, anything sensible or something.
Yeah. Well, there was and then I in this essay also discuss were really destructive civil wars in Africa, where these rebel groups would seize diamonds because Africa's like the regions in Africa, certain regions are rich in diamonds. And they'd sometimes force people, basically as slaves, to collect the diamonds, and they'd sell them on the international market to make money and to buy weapons. And all the Jews controlling the diamond companies and diamond exchanges and all the demand for the diamonds and all that was controlled by Jews. And they even had like some of these Jew diamond companies would even form like kind of partnerships with these rebel groups. And
Yeah, I'm
then
sure.
you had like the US, it was again, that was just was during the so-called Cold War, and you had the USA, USSR, Cuba as well, and South Africa, all Jewish controlled, and then they were all like kind of controlling both sides. So it wasn't yeah,
Okay.
that's the, yeah, go ahead.
Let me ask you another question. This is about populations and population control, which is well, an interesting topic.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the official view is that it was first raised by in the around about the time of the Napoleonic Wars. Oh God, I've forgotten his name. Who was the bloke who wrote about food being needed to keep populations going?
Malthus? Malthus.
Malthus.
Yeah.
Hot stuff. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying. I was reading a book by an English professor, a Jewish professor called Hobsbawm, and he said, "Oh well, Malthus is pretty pointless. It's not important." And I, you see, if you're in charge of, if you consider you've got power of life and death and if it have, it sort of prize it's kept underground, then Malthus is not important. I mean, of course, you need food, but if you're controlling it, it's a bit like animals. You know, if you're controlling a herd of things, you can grow, you can enlarge it or diminish it. And I wonder to what extent you think that you know, Jews must have been responsible for massive genocides. But if they haven't, the populations in these places like Russia, China, well, I suppose America, the USA, the Civil War knocked off hundreds of thousands. And Europe as well, of course, particularly the 30 Years' War. There's lots and lots of these things where Jews took a lot part. If the Jews hadn't taken part, then it's possible that whites and others and all others would have had to develop their own policies about population control. So there is that issue. If Jews were all exterminated, then there'd still be potential problems with population, particularly, for example, in Africa, where they're completely given new stuff which they would never have developed themselves. And if their population is supposed to be heading for 1 billion, given a few generations, 1 billion in what used to be, you know, a few million in, say, about 1850, when Africa started to be explored.
Yeah.
So, but that, I just don't see how populations that size can be sustainable. I just, you know, because of their general lack of, you know, lack of ability. Any more than you could get.
Genocides and there were famines in the USSR and China. I cover a lot of that in my book. I think they were deliberately caused by Jews. You know, they confiscated food and they sold it to make money.
Yeah.
And even the Ukraine was a huge grain producing center. Europe never had a problem with famine, really, food shortage. It was a systematic, you know, they called in the country and got sort of mercenaries to collect the food, and they killed anybody who tried to minimize the famine or feed people. That is a very effective way to exterminate people. That's the it's called the Holodomor.
Holodomor, yeah.
And that's one example. But there was famine in the 20s. There was famine in Kazakhstan, and all superintended by Jews. And it was in China in connection with the so-called Great Leap Forward. God, they give this thing the Great Leap Forward. Oh my God.
Have you pieced that together? Have you got a section on China?
Yeah, I've got a section on
somewhere there. It's not
how Jews are.
It's not the chapter title though.
No, I've got a subsection. My book's I've kind of got subtitles.
Yeah, of course you have. That's quite a good way. It's a good way of doing it.
Yeah. So while I don't have an index, I think that does help if you're trying to find something.
Well, so does your little description. When you have your book titles or journal titles or internet titles, you often give a little description of what these titles are like.
Yeah.
Which is very useful.
Just a sentence or two, you know, that helps, right. You know. Can help someone wasting their time on something, I think, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the way you describe some of these things, actually, like Lipstadt's book. I think you just said it was complete rubbish.
Yeah.
Rather than being sort of unnecessarily polite.
Yeah.
We've been something like an hour and a bit. Do you want to stop? This is very kind of under-rehearsed and everything. So.
Yeah.
But it's nice to speak to you. I'm glad. I do think more people should speak, and not just, you know, not just these wretched ones who don't say anything and
yeah,
and are too conventional.
Right.
Because we've got to push through this stuff, haven't we?